Hello and welcome to Nobody Wake the Bugbear, Australia's biggest podcast for their mothership sci-fi horror RPG. This is the campaign retrospective and questionnaire, fan questionnaire that we are podcasting right now. Welcome back to part two. I am Andrew the Warden, and I'm joined once again by Josh, Doug, and Samantha. Sam and John is not here with us because he's, you know, the story.
Hey, guys.
Hey, guys. There he is. No, he's away. But anyway, since you're listening to this, you've obviously listened to the part one. So we are continuing now on to the fan questions. These are questions you have submitted to us over the last month since the campaign has finished. And we're going to answer a few of them right now. Shall we start? Everyone ready? You had a good break for a week?
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. I had a good time. Yeah. Look, here's a picture of when I put an axe in my finger when a while ago.
Josh is holding up his phone with it's an appendage, I'll tell you that.
It's definitely my finger. Yeah.
I don't know if it's a digit or not. Now I know.
It was a digit at some point.
And then, yeah, I put an axe into it and they had to remove the nail bed and put it back together.
Yeah.
Yeah, just a tip. Yep.
I'm glad we got to share that.
It was great.
All right. Here we go.
Used to it.
These are the questions people have paid money for from Patreons and free listeners. Okay, Josh, put it away. It's like a very sad penis.
A very bony penis.
Very bony, bloody penis. All right. Back on track. We're 3 minutes in, and that feels like just a whiplash of an intro. And don't you think?
Yeah, guys, you want to see my finger?
Jesus Christ.
Smell my finger, yeah.
Smell my finger.
Okay, here we go.
It smells fine now.
It's just pasta sauce.
Q&A questions. We have one right now. Let's start off with a bit of an icebreaker question. This one's from LS. Nobody Wake the Bugbear. Your campaign seems to have the momentum of a runaway freight train. Why are you so popular? Sam? Thanks for your question, LS.
Thanks, LS.
A very good question.
I don't know. Really? Don't know. I feel like I'm the wrong person to answer the question.
You know what this is referring to?
What is it referring to?
Simpsons Season 2, when Burns comes to the classroom and Lisa Simpson is given the question. It's a fake question for
you. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I just thought it would be funny because it matched completely.
Okay.
I changed Mr. Burns from, yeah. Anyway, that's not the real question.
But I was literally, if you came to me, I was going to be like, are we actually, I don't think we're famous.
Yeah, I was like, we're just doing stuff, man.
I was going to say, that's very flattering, LS.
We have tens of listeners. It's great.
For the real.
LS is an anagram for warden.
For the real question, to start us off, it is an icebreaker question from Ran. I don't know how to pronounce this, but it's RANNE.
Why are you looking at me? I can't even spell my own name.
That's because it'd be comical if you, the dyslexic member of the podcast.
Rain,
yes.
That's how I've been reading it.
There's no I there.
But that's how I've been reading it.
Right, for the whole cast. Considering all the player characters everyone has made, fuck, marry, kill, go.
Is this our characters or is this everyone's?
I think
characters? Everyone's.
That's what John said, but.
Look, everyone's clearly fucking Buck.
Yeah.
Speak for yourself. Here is the list. I'm going to rapid shotgun the list. Here we go. Jeremiah Dutch, mentally kinetic biomechanical host, Merkaba, Alec Jackson, Zachary Doppler, Android, Raphael, Dr. Harry Keane, Dr. Eli Darko, Nova Blue, Charles E. Maxwell or Mouse, Captain Miles Crown, Buck Fernand, Evelyn Adkins, Tony Beretta, Octavie Sheremai, Simon Burr, Charlie Valentine, Dorian Black, Stargazer, Natalie, Mads Glockner, Caden Sardine or Fish, Rudolph Lundgren, Mark Jenkins, Rian Prince, Julian Smithers, Ukti Brandish, Gordon Good, Dr. Cameron Elias, Dr. Craig Graham, Lonely Cloud, Lord Lupus Clay, Boon of Tech Tyke, Morgan, and Imde Su. That is all our characters we've ever played on this podcast. Did I miss anyone?
Do it again, but in song this time.
I honestly couldn't piece together a single option for kill because I just can't remember who would have ticked me off.
Let's start with just your characters, Josh. Let's go. Go for it.
All right, we've got Cyber, Ukti, Rian, Tony. There's one from the blue.
Lonely Cloud, Harry Kane. Harry Kane.
Marry Lonely Cloud.
Marry sure. Lonely Cloud.
Done. Lonely Cloud. It was depressing but sweet. I mean, if I'm going to kill one of my characters, Who was the one from Blue?
Harry Kane. Dr. Harry Kane.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to kill Kane because he's just forgettable. Like, who cares?
All right. Well, I remember.
And, man.
What was his voice? My name's Harry Kane.
That's good shot, Gordon.
No.
Yeah, I can't pick anyone. There is no fuck in my list.
You have to answer the question. That's what I should have said at the start.
You started with the whole, all of them. And I was like, look, Buck's just wild enough for me to, you know, if I was going to swing left.
You may choose outside your character's list for if you're stuck. So who would you
choose? Well,
kill?
Yeah, look, well.
John has chosen from everyone and he's got two lists.
And nobody will be offended if you choose to kill and or fuck their character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would be more offended if you fucked them than killed them, to be honest.
Do you know what? Can I fuck and kill Buck?
Yeah, that's what I'm
not necessarily in that order.
Just in the same degree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like a bit of like Widow Spider action.
Yeah.
Just eat them. I think that's my list is kill Kane, marry Lonely Cloud, and fuck Buck or the only female character on the entire list of characters. Was it Dr. Elias? The only female, right?
Did nobody else play a female?
I did. I played Evelyn.
Oh, Natalie is technically a female. Natalie. I played.
Are you a luck of pleasure model? Would you happen to be a pleasure model?
I think I'll go fuck Buck because he sounds like fun.
Why is he choosing Buck? Why
Buck's
is he suddenly
got some
in
tricks
a,
up his sleeve, all right?
But it's,
he's very in touch
it's
with
the
himself.
Energy. It's exactly because he's in touch with
he's
himself.
He's got BD.
Maybe he knows how to touch everyone else too.
Any man that's super happy to show me his butthole knows what he's doing.
Let me just say, he was walking around that spaceship naked. Yeah, Buck's got it.
He's packing meat. He's got a third leg.
And right. You too.
They called him Donkey Buck for a reason.
Right.
He's like a rodeo. He's a bucking bull.
Yeah, we really have a bias towards creating male characters on this podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you answered that question?
Oh, yeah. Fuck Buck, marry Craig because he's a family man, and then kill Darko because I feel like Darko would get off on that.
Yeah, look, Darko was the other option for kill. I'll be honest.
There's no blood in the stars, only dust.
Or the old guy from Empress, whose name I forgot, the one I played.
Lord Lupus Clay.
Lord Lupus Clay, because he's already on his fucking deathbed anyway.
That's a bit of a mercy kill then, I guess.
Yeah.
All right, we'll go clockwise.
Please.
I will go marry Raphael, because he probably, as you said, look after you. It's a doctor, very straight down the line. Fuck Rudy. He's a bit of a Chad. You know, everyone wants a bit of Rudy. And kill Julian Smithers. He's a freaking asshole.
He was
annoying and would probably sell you out to dry for the company. And Sam?
Yeah, like I said, I'd fuck and kill Buck.
Okay.
Because like...
Yeah, that's a good
You know what I mean? It's just the vibe. Mm. He'd shit me off, but
you
gotta have a crack at it.
Yeah, exactly.
And then I feel like I'd probably marry Dorian Black because he's tortured but reliable.
That is true. Very reliable.
So... Mm-hmm. You know, that's fine. I can overlook the brooding
I can fix him.
Trauma. And
he doesn't have an elongated anus.
Yeah, that helps.
That's
really helps.
Simon.
It really does, yeah.
That's Simon.
What did John say?
We'll get to that. We'll get everyone's and then we'll
go
to John last. You missed. Did you get? Oh, you marry and Buck.
Yeah. No.
Cheater.
Fucking kill.
Cheater. Fucking kill. What's order?
You can do all three and then get a decent life insurance payout.
Okay.
It'd be worth quite a bit.
Yeah, but I don't want to hang my star on that, you know?
I mean, for the amount of
money.
I
want to tie my horse to that cart.
All right. Should we hear John's answers? Read in the voice of Gordon Good. Okay, I need some ground rules. Is this among all our characters? Because I'm not sure how I feel about talking about my friend's characters. But if I'm talking about just mine, then it feels a little narcissistic. Okay, I'll do both. You've worn me down.
Real arm twist.
Among the characters I've made, fuck Natalie. Call me a coward, but I'm a heterosexual. And the only other female I've played was a robot. Marry probably Boon of Tektite from Cloud Empress. He was loyal and would protect me. Kill Charlie Valentine. He's dreadful.
Yeah.
And among the whole cast, this is John also talking, F, fuck. Again, my options are slim, being heterosexual. He's not willing to even deviate there, is he?
Die.
Leave nothing to the imagination.
Yeah. I know it's a funny meme, but I like women. That ain't at home. So probably Dr. Elias, even though she's got some hang-ups.
That's very true. Yeah. That's very true.
Marry Tony Beretta. This is the only correct option. If anyone else says anything different, they are wrong. And kill Octavie Cherami is a crusty old Satanist. Do not like him.
I still think it's fucking hilarious. I played a Satanist in his only game that he ran.
That's so funny.
So that's Silence of Narcissus, and that's Doug's character rolling a tattoo of Baphomet for his patch.
Yeah.
So yeah, didn't go down very well, but it worked well in the story.
It was fun.
All right, I think that was a bit of fun. I think we all got good answers. Shall we move on?
Yep.
Yep.
So that's for you, Ran. Rain.
Why is Tony the only correct picker?
Look,
he has his reasons.
I wouldn't have gone with Tony.
I feel like Craig is the family man.
Tony's a schmoozer, though.
I feel
though.
Like we need some comments from the listeners on this one now.
I feel like we'll have a retrospective of the Q&A's Q&A.
Yeah, we'll need everyone's answers on the fuck, marry, kill.
Yeah, we'll do a Discord one.
Yeah.
All right.
I think yes, Buck is the prime option for a fuck, but I feel like next to Buck, Tony comes off as a person that knows how
it's
to give a good
firm
time.
It's the firm hands of a blue-collar worker that really does it, you know?
He gives as good as he gets.
All right. Got a massive tool. Sorry. All right.
Here to fix your plumbing.
Next question, or destroy it, is Chris. Chris Bio Cryo Ario. Ario. Chris Ario. We know Chris.
Hey, Chris.
Don't we? Chris says to Andrew, oh, that's me. What's the one piece from Gradient Descent, room, encounter, item, whatever, that you would have wished made it into the podcast? Interesting. It's a huge book. It's a mega dungeon. 6 levels. There is a lot. This campaign could have gone years with this kind of stuff that's in this. But I would say probably the factory, which is floor 3. It is the largest section of the deep. And it's full of things like just some of the names of the rooms. This is what was explained to you from Arcady. He gave you some insight onto this, but I'll tell you it again. What have we got here? One second, I am looking.
While you're doing that, I think it's not necessarily a scene, but a great favorite of the campaign is the intro that's read out and the voice effects that are put over that from John. I think it was a great choice of intro. Good work.
Well, it was a great trailer. Here we go.
Great music.
Floor 3 is the factory where all the android production takes place. It is split into 7 levels, 7 phases. You've got maintenance. You've got skeleton works, pseudo-flesh farms. You've got brain construction, disassembly, storage, quality assurance. Boy, if you guys got to quality assurance, you would have had like a kid in a candy shop. Just, I won't elaborate further because who knows what we play next. I do want to say
there's a lot of artifacts,
keep some stuff, especially from the cast.
I reckon.
What?
What?
I'll get that when I listen back to the recording.
That's so fine.
Go fuck yourself. the factory, largest and most interesting floor, quality assurance, definitely. I also think that floor 6, which is engineering, would have been an interesting start as a campaign. It definitely could have been that because you can access that straight away. If you had gone through the security station Bravo, past the gym first, before going to the kitchen way, I reckon you would have got to the elevator going down to hell and going down to engineering. You could have done that. But I think it was explained that it was the further down you go, you maybe predicted it would be at worse and more dangerous.
Yeah.
Well, hell really drives at home.
Yeah. I think the only exception was the very last floor, which isn't as bad as the second last floor where Monarch actually lives. I think was the only exception to that rule.
Yeah, the floor where Arcady didn't want to talk about, floor 5, it's not known where it is. Yeah. Basically, no one's been able to return.
It's between floor 4 and 6, Andrew.
Logically, yes, but it could be this is kilometers worth. You don't know if it's like a sequential sort of thing. So, yeah, I reckon the factory, that's a whole campaign. We were limited in our time, not what we wanted to do. Definitely want to do more. But thank you, Chris. That's a great question. Moving on from Dungeon Maestro, we have a question for the whole cast. For the whole cast. You've played Mosh from Zero Edition to final release. We haven't. I do believe we started with the preview, the work in progress playtest of version one. So I've never played Zero Edition.
I thought we... No, we played Zero. We played the playtest and then we were playing Zero.
No, nope, never played Zero.
Okay. Didn't we?
100% never played Zero. It's always been the playtest version of one, which is in its form now. Just a few things were changed, you know, as we were playing.
I think that's true.
But one's quite different. So
well, definitely. The playtest has been different to one anyway.
The playtest changes a lot.
Yeah. With the rule changes in between, how did that affect your enjoyment or ease of play? What changes were you most grateful for or had the biggest impact on the way you played? And finally, is there anything you miss or prefer from the previous iterations that got changed? Doug.
Fucking stun grenade.
Well, there's no such thing as a stun grenade. We know that.
I think, I liked, with a lot of the change, there was a lot of balancing tweaks and whatnot. It's a lot harder to just start with an endgame weapon like we did initially when we just fucking rolled a death laser. For the most part, it wasn't as noticeable. The only time I really noticed the change was when we were bringing old characters up into Gradient Descent.
Yeah, you get an extra 5 to your stats.
Yeah, and all of our loadouts. And that was when I was just like, well, fuck, this is actually really... Because I made my guy in the app and it was like really hard to like make shit.
Well,
all my gear was old gear
from the first edition before the release first edition, when it was already pretty much set in stone, all the prices were changed. That was a big difference. So everything was the same, but all the costs changed. So things became a lot more expensive.
Yeah.
So you couldn't buy the stuff that you wanted to before.
And I think the ammo system got tweaked as well from memory, because I ended up with a lot more fucking ammo than I did initially.
That's just you being stupid. Josh, what do you think? I don't think there's much, is there? Oh, there's one.
Go on, Andrew.
But I think you might think of it, but I'll suggest it if you don't. Go.
What, the nerfing of the heavy machine gun?
That is one. That's a big one. That's affected. It changed from 3D10 with advantage to just 4D10 flat, I do believe.
I think so, something like that.
But you loved rolling 6D10 and choosing the best, right?
Yeah, there was a whole process, but it slowed the game down.
Yeah, I understand why they did it.
So, you know, it makes sense. I think there's still work to go on this particular element, but the descriptive nature of the rule set had improved from the first playtest edition through to the different iterations to allow for better interpretation. Again, I still feel like it needs to improve because there are some parts where it's too open and we end up getting to a point where none of us can figure out, unless we were to, you know, message the crew.
Well, they just want me to make it up. You just got to make it up.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think sometimes when things are really open, it makes it difficult to hone in on an answer for some things. But I think, you know, by the end of it all, really, none of the changes were hard to adapt to. So I found it quite easy to move on with each of the changes. There wasn't really anything that I was like, oh, no, or, oh, my God, that's so amazing. I think there were a couple of things I was like, oh, that's nice.
Yeah, exactly. Things got more descriptive. Things made more sense. It wasn't just like, what the fuck actually is this? Mm. There was a lot more, okay, so that's what that is.
The capacity for the game to function is what would improve each time. And if it gotten worse or stayed the same, then I would have been maybe disappointed.
Made it less confusing, cleared up a few things.
Yeah.
Sam? I know you've only played the recent one edition, so.
Well, yeah, but I think there was a change. Well, hang on.
In wounds?
Because because when we played initially in the one shots, I think there was changes between the one shots and Gradient Descent.
Correct.
But I think that was when the cost of things changed. Did the panic system change? Or have I imagined
Not
that?
Not since the first edition playtests.
Okay.
They did tweak the table a little bit, but the system was the same.
Yeah, so I think the cost of things made a difference for when you were trying to decide your loadout, because I'd played in those other one shots where like things were more accessible, I guess.
Yeah, you got the recon drone.
Yeah. Mm. Well, I think I rolled that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
I think they took it out.
Yeah, yeah. They did, which was super handy. Like that was the whole thing that like it was a cool part of Year of the Rat using the recon. Using the, what was that the recon? No, it was the other one, the sample drone, the salvage drone.
Salvage.
Is the salvage drone still in there, isn't it?
Let me check just quickly. I do believe they took one drone out. I'm just seeing which one it was. Keep talking.
Yeah, because the salvage drone, at least, if that's the one they've taken out, was a super good part of Year of the Rat, like having the drone put the tokens in to try to get the
black
box.
Salvage drone is now 10K, but is still in there.
Yeah.
It's been tweaked down.
Yeah.
So it no longer can carry a whole shitload.
Yeah.
It's been nerfed slightly and there's no recon drone at all.
Yeah. Yeah, the recon drone would have been handy in some instances. But yeah, I guess that's really the only thing that impacted me. And because I sort of like come into it fresh every time, I don't try to rely on memory. Like anytime we would play a game or create characters or anything like that, it's just like start from scratch, look at the material, decide on things then and there. It didn't really impact me too greatly. So that's something I'm thankful for.
Yeah. It's simple enough as a game to take the new updates in stride.
Yeah.
Without having to worry too much about learning a whole bunch of new book material.
Like it's not like you're jumping from AD&D to 3.5 to 5, right. You know.
Yeah.
The only major difference I was going to mention for you, Josh, and for all of us is wounds. Guns don't do wounds anymore.
Yeah. The shotgun.
It's now 4d10 that's the biggest damage usually. And the other one was the death cup and having an extra set of wounds. Remember, Josh, you would take a third wound, then have health again, and then die if you were to take a fourth wound.
Yeah.
But now they just said, nope, 3 wounds, you take the third wound, you will die. So roll a death check. So that's much confusing and gone.
Yeah, again, that was the fact that it was clarifying was better than anything.
Lastly, we have John's answer.
Hey.
Unless you want to add something more, Josh, John, Doug.
Doug.
Hey.
You over there.
All the peoples. You forgot Sam while you're at it.
Yeah.
Josh, John, Doug, Sam.
I feel like the tables, like the damage tables and all of that have gotten a lot.
How the turns have tabled.
How the turns have tabled. I feel like, all the wound tables and stuff felt more... Like your stress tables and all that just felt more like impactier. Like
that's a word.
There was a lot of
impactful.
Impactful. Thank you. I have the like I feel like I got punished a lot more when things did go wrong versus earlier on in the game where we just
to be fair though
seemed to get away with a lot of bullshit.
You did have a low hit point level though compared to everyone else.
Yeah.
I think what was it like 11?
Yeah, but I never took. Like, I never took a wound. It was all, like, stress-related shit, you know?
Really?
Yeah.
I could have sworn
Dr. Craig was fine.
Yeah.
Because he's a coward.
I swear someone had, like, 11 or 13, and they took one attack and then dropped, like, a wound.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, my God, okay. Good for me having 19 health.
I think that was that Bug Hump when I got fucking nuked?
No, I'm talking about Ingredient Descent.
Oh, yeah.
I could have sworn someone took a hit and they had barely any health and they went below.
It was Gordon. Gordon took one hit.
I'm pretty sure Gordon was the only one took a hit.
And Dr. Elias. On the last running, got slashed in the back. Tony got gouged in the eye.
Yeah, like combat, and this is what I like because combat has consequences, but like the consequences of combat felt so much.
Right, we got extra questions to this effect. We're going off track, but that is, we think we impacted the changes. We're pretty good.
What was John's answer?
Here it is. What's another character voice he's got? Boone?
Darko.
Boone? I can't do it.
MK.
MK.
MK?
Yeah.
MK.
I don't think I can do his voice. Honestly, I've never been a rules guy, but I've been a vibes guy. I always admired the rest of my table for being able to make up for my lack of diligence. So in regards to the rule change between editions, I only noticed it when I was trying to readjust to the wound rules. And frankly, never really got the hang of it in the end. I just had to be happy being a little baby kicking my little legs in my little high chair. On the bright side, it also means I never tried to pull any fast ones with rules lawyer antics. That's it.
Facts, John. Facts.
Facts.
So the moral of the story is we didn't really notice it.
No. And yeah, we haven't played Zero Edition, so we didn't notice any of the big sweeping changes.
There's also the rules also don't allow you to necessarily pull a fast one with too much
rule. No, it's up to the interpretation. Oh, here we got some cast. I've organized this into cast and character questions. These are direct questions about your characters from the listeners. Here's one from C the Third. For the cast, what has been your favorite adventure? Which character did you enjoy playing the most? Do you wish to have developed more? Doug?
I mean, I haven't shied away from Moonbase Blue being my favorite. I loved it to bits. Favorite character, ironically, wasn't the one that I created. It was 100% Kerensky.
Nice.
I fucking had so much fun playing Kerensky.
Still alive.
Still alive. Rare treat. And what was the last part?
Would you have developed more?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's always room for improvement. There's always room for growth in characters. Yeah. I
think any character you would have played in more time is more chance of development. But who would you wish you had developed more, I guess, is the question?
I mean, I wish Craig got more time to flesh out all that bullshit that I wrote.
Yeah.
But as far as development, again, the Empress guy whose name is just not going to stick in my head.
Lord Lupus Clay.
Lupus Clay. There is so much that I could do with Clay.
Yeah, we'll have to play Empress again once.
Yeah.
Once more.
And I feel like Clay's just got his whole little story, even at that old age, kicking around.
Sam?
I have two favorites. So, Year of the Rat.
I think the favorite adventure, I don't think it's limited to Mothership.
Yeah.
It could be your favorite. John certainly had a different answer for his favorite adventure.
Yeah. I think Year of the Rat was super fun. That was super fun. The ending was so good. Like, it was fun. And then, will Homeostasis be out by the time this? Is
Next
is
May.
On the Patreon?
May.
Patreon?
Come out some Patreon on May.
Okay.
But yeah, that is very good.
Yes.
I have sort of omitted characters from that.
Yeah.
Because it hasn't been released yet, but it's definitely up there.
Yeah. Yeah. If I can mention that was my another one of my favorite ones to play. For characters, what was the second part of the question?
It was, what character did you enjoy playing the most and do you wish developed more?
Okay. I think I enjoyed playing Buck the most. even though he didn't feature super heavily in this adventure, narratively, in Year of the Rat, it was fun. And then he was like the comic relief in between absolute, terrifying instances that would happen. So just being able to, keep it light and fun. It would be interesting to, if I had chosen to take him instead of Elias, for example, it would be interesting to see how he would develop. But I also like the fact that he is, kind of untainted by, all he knows is winning and he doesn't have to deal with, the mess.
Well, certainly not now the fungus has taken hold.
Yeah,
untainted is...
yeah, well, he was untainted. And, he's just him. So, I don't know, it would have taken the buck out of Buck, I think, if he had gone. Yeah.
If it's not Mothership related, I will probably say my favorite adventure so far was the very first one we ever played together, Hell Comes a Glittering.
Oh, yeah.
That was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that one.
You had a good character? Did you have a...
I played a short drow.
Yeah.
It was a whole piss take on...
That's right.
John's character from Gondolgrim.
Josh, your last? Lucky last?
As much as I like Tony, I really liked playing Ukti Brandish. If he hadn't been infected and used as an opportunity to sacrifice himself for the livelihood of his crewmates, I think he would have been really fun to play in the deep.
Doc, you son of a bitch. What are you doing here?
You goddamn son of a bitch. And adventure-wise, if it's outside of Mothership, Cloud Empress was good fun, great fun. But as far as Mothership goes, it's really hard. I'd say Ypsilon 14 and the Deep are both really good adventures, but the Silence on Narcissus, John's one, was, you know, considering he built it from the ground up, very, very good. And I thought he did a killer job on
that. Oh, yeah. As once you listen to Homeostasis, if you haven't checked the drafts, it's very good.
You know, like Cryoclones was a lot of fun.
I think Cryoclones solidified being the first one we can play two of in one go as a planned one, what a campaign would look like, because the depth of some of those scenes were really good. Very good series, Bioclones. Biodrone, sorry.
So I guess, yeah, in terms of, you know, really enjoyed the homebrew of Silence and Narcissus. As far as the pre, like the campaigns that were written, Ypsilon and Gradient Descent, really top tier. As far as the podcast as a whole, really loved Cloud Empress as a non-standard module that we'd played.
Yeah. Because, adventure, you know, in its own right.
Exactly, because we played plenty of Mothership and we played plenty of Dungeons & Dragons, and they're both really good systems and they do a really good job of building it. But Cloud Empress was very unique in terms of anything that we'd ever done, and I really enjoyed getting to take a break from something that was familiar.
Yeah, if you guys haven't played Cloud Empress, check it out. I also absolutely loved it. It's a good, fun little... A little kit bash for Mothership. It's good fun.
Great. Very good. I believe I've got an answer. And then John's. We'll do mine. Favorite adventure? Probably going to have to be Gradient Descent, because even the small slice we've had was just amazing. And the depth that it can still, pardon the pun, the depth of the adventure is still a lot more to go. I think we can get a lot more out of it as well. And that's why I don't want to spoil it too much, because just in case, on the off chance we play it again, John comes back, whatever's available, I do want to return. What else? Favorite adventure that isn't that would be Ghosts of Gondolgrim and the Dungeons & Dragons. Our first campaign that we finished, my first campaign that I've ever finished being Dungeons & Dragons since 2015, being in many games that stop started, went for a long time, but then never finished. This is one we finished from start to end, and it was, couldn't have ended any better. So that's my favorite, definitely. Character that I wished playing the most. I always loved playing Rudy. I liked playing Julian Smithers, and I liked playing Raphael. They're all great characters.
Which Rudy?
Yeah, you play a lot of Rudy.
I think it just, you transcends. Mean Rudy? Or, yeah. That's the same one. Yeah.
Was the Rudy from my one shot, was that the first iteration of Rudy, or has Rudy just been our character?
No, that's the first time I played him. Yeah. And then I think he showed up. I don't know if he showed up there first and then our campaign, maybe as a side joke. One or the other, same thing.
He showed up somewhere as a piss take and then kept showing up as a piss take. Yeah, became so an under the table running gag between us.
I wish, developed more. Julian Smithers, I wish he had been there in the background through Year of the Rat's shenanigans, but he went back to the ship to sort of hide the fact that he's got android blood coming out of his, you know, but that would have been cool, because if you had exposed it there, he might have stuck around, but you guys wanted him to bugger off, so, because he was shady. So that's all I have to say. Now John is last. His favorite adventure is a D&D series, without question, even though I know it's isn't what the question's supposed to be about. He says, seriously, it's a marvelous adventure, and if you all listen to our D&D, I will love you forever. Five ever. In regards to Mosh, that's a tricky one. The campaign has been creeping up my list recently just because of the time and development we had. Gordon and Merkaba are characters that I adore playing, which is why I picked them. I'm mostly very happy with the work I did. I think they're iconic characters. I'm willing to say that. My favorite adventure right now might be actually Biodrones and Cryoclones. Precisely because Charlie Valentine is a character I enjoyed exploring, and I would certainly be interested in playing him again, maybe in season two, baby!
You got to do FinTok next.
I was supposed to do Charlie. What's Charlie's?
He's Jason Statham.
My favorite adventure right now might be actually Biodrones and Cryoclones. I don't know. It's an English one. Characters I like to develop the most would be both the Moonbase characters I've made. Dr. Eli Darko especially felt like something I had something, but the adventure was so wild so quickly that I didn't get much of a chance to go deeper with him. So Eli Darko would his regrettably not developed some more.
Sure, not talking about Stargazer.
Stargazer.
Please proceed to the nearest airlock. The famous line. You remember that?
Yeah.
Is that everyone?
Yeah.
I think that's everyone. Question answered. Thank you. See the third. Next question. Dungeon Maestro. Let me change the music here. Is there something less stressful?
Bit of synthwave.
For Sam.
Hey.
Dungeon Maestro. Question for Sam. You jumped into a show that had been going for a while with an established cast that had gotten a few sessions under their belts already. How did you find the mosh as a system to learn as you got into it? How did Buck's character concept come about?
Okay, so the system to learn, I think, was relatively simple. Coming from a D&D background especially, like, it's so much more involved. There's so many, it's so specific with, like, doing a perception check or, you know, these specific skills that are used for just the most mundane tasks as part of the game. Whereas Mothership's a lot more, it's a lot broader, where it's kind of just like, I'm just going to do this thing. And unless it's something really specialized, it doesn't really rely on a skill check or anything like that. So I think coming over from that was relatively easy. I had to sort of unlearn some of those habits that you tempted to, like, ask to do specific skill checks and things like that. In terms of Buck, it was kind of, I think I decided on Buck while we were sitting here randomly rolling for characters.
I think we have to mention that the vast majority of our now classic characters
were random,
were literally rolled the moment we sat down to play the game.
Yeah.
This is true for Ukti Brandish, Merkaba, Dutch, Gordon Good. He may have thought he wanted to play an out-of-work football star as a Teamster, but Buck, definitely.
Craig.
Yeah.
Craig.
I wanted to make a combat medic, and that was about it.
I think the whole thing hinged on him rolling for his token, which was a pamphlet on interpreting sheep dreams.
Oh, yeah.
And
sleep dreams or sheep?
Sheep dreams. And based on that, I put, like, his skills in mysticism and, you know, like, that just kind of started the ball rolling. And just because my brain's weird, I was like, you know who'd be fun and is kind of annoying? Tony Robbins.
And that, loosely based.
Yeah, loosely based.
So loosely based.
Mildly orbiting around the idea.
I can see exactly where Tony Robbins comes into it, but I can also see where, like, the drug dealer from Grandma's Boy also, like, ties into that California stoner vibe.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, like, there's nothing special behind it. And kind of that's how I do most of my characters is I don't put a lot of thought and emphasis in backstory.
Pre-planning sort of thing.
Yeah, because I feel like, one, I work better that way. Two, I feel like if I put in this whole, like, backstory and narrative and all of this stuff that's pre-planned and decided before actually playing, I find that that sometimes limits my decision-making and development as playing a character, because characters are just people and they make decisions and they change and develop as you do things. So sometimes having that, like, prescriptive nature of, like, this is who I am and these are what my, all of my values are, and I won't, you know, change on any of that, makes it difficult sometimes then to develop organically through, like, playing the game or the adventure.
In my case, make friends when you do something that your character would do and then that person doesn't like you.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm sorry.
My character wanted it.
This is from Dungeon Maestro, but staying on you, Sam, just a little bit.
Yeah.
Got a question from CD. They're interested too for Dr. Elias. Since you didn't play the horror of Tau Sigma 7, how extensively Andrew and Sam fleshed that out? All of that backstory, just a quick conversation. Did Sam read the module, something else?
I came in with the idea.
Yes.
Andrew then said after the fact, I think it was after we finished that session maybe, about the Tau Sigma 7 adventure and there being something similar in there around, like, a monster with lots of tentacles and all of that sort of that imagery. So then Andrew sent me the module, which I had a brief look at, but it didn't, it, like the context of the module didn't really matter.
Yeah.
Because it's more about what's happening there and then, and it's sort of just the tint of how Cameron does and sees things, but it's more, the emphasis is more on what happens while you're here. So it was really super brief. It was not super like detailed in terms of our planning. It just kind of happened.
Yeah, basically we did episode one. We recorded all those sessions, the three sessions at Prospero in one go. And the first session was that. And I literally in the 15-minute break we had, I said, Sam, how about we do a scene with Dr. Elias in therapy?
Yep.
And maybe this worm, you could have played, you could have, she could have been in this sort of situation, which I saw an actual play of Tau Sigma 7. And I think knew about it from that. So I said, maybe it's the worm from this, the red worm. And she sort of took with that and ran with it. And then after the session had finished, the week after, I sent her the adventure itself.
Yep.
But yeah, no, that was fleshed out just in the break, in the moment between the episode. Basically 15 minutes done straight into the scene. It was the first thing we did. It was great work.
Smell a prequel coming along.
Well, we know she survives. So we play that. We already know she lives.
She's just a background NPC.
Yeah.
There's some more questions on Sam. I think we'll overwhelm her, then we'll let her have a rest.
Yeah, go for it.
This one's from A.V. Guzman or Av Guzman.
Guzman.
Av Guzman.
G-Y-G.
For Sam. Serious question.
Okay.
Dr. Elias was a great character. And even though we haven't met them in a previous adventure, had clearly been through something that deeply affected them and helped motivate some incredible choices in the last few episodes, especially towards the end. How much did you flesh out of that character's backstory? Any you would like to share? I think you've answered this.
Yeah, I kind of did. Like, not a lot, honestly. Very little. Only the idea that, like, she's a doctor, she's an exobiologist, she researches, you know, alien life forms, things like that. And then it kind of developed from that point on. The way that Cameron, like, developed as a character throughout, it just seemed like it made sense as things, like I said, for me, just allowing character develop organically is important. I try not to force it. One, because I feel like I'm not very good at it. If I do force it, it doesn't feel right for me. And two, it just makes more sense narratively if, like, things change with the character as a result of direct action that maybe you didn't foresee or plan or anything during the actual game.
Sure. Less serious. What in the world would we have done if Dr. Elias had died in the first dive? Would Buck have actually gone in?
Buck would have gone in.
I think the answer is yes.
Yes, Buck would have gone in. And then it would have been really, like I said, I think I said it earlier, it would have been really interesting to see what happened, because I think Buck would have changed from maybe who he is and has been. Like, he sort of changed through Year of the Rat even.
Yeah.
Because he started off as this, like, very sort of serious, going for a job interview, kind of holding the team together of misfits while they try to rob the ship. And then at the end, he's so lucky he survived and he bursts out of the rat with, you know, the black box, and he kind of develops into this other person who's so lucky and, you know, is touched by fate and everything that he really rides into that. And then he fails and then he ends up where he is. So for him to go into this really, I guess, psychologically mind-bending, horrifying at times situation, like, he would have probably been very different.
I think the mysticism and his outlook would have steeled himself to a lot of the psychological impacts of the deep, not so much the combat. He might have struggled there, but definitely the sanity stuff and dealing with the, he might have had idioms to sayings to sort of recover from some of the weirdness.
Yeah, I think that's definitely, like, part of it. And I also think that it could have gone the other way. You know, like, the degree at which he sort of sees that mysticism in everyday harmless, you know, situations where he sees somebody struggling with something or coming to some decision about something, and he'll put his quip in that sort of, like, tries to spin it on the positive. But when you're in another situation where you're kind of copying it all the time and nothing is positive and everything, like, it becomes really difficult to see the bright side of things, and it could have, like, impacted his sort of, taken his shine off a bit, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, he would have gone in.
Excellent. This one's not a question from Sorry, Doug?
I said I would have loved to have seen that.
Yeah. This one's not a question, but to round off your engagement, we'll give you a little break after this one from Av Guzman again. Excellent work on Dr. Elias's breakdown when meeting the Minotaur. After being so calm and collected for the whole dive, that moment was a highlight of the campaign for them.
Oh, thank you.
Very good.
It was, yeah. I was wondering if something like that would come up, and I thought, like, the build-up, it was important to try to do it justice.
Yeah.
And look, I'll be 100% honest. Role-playing to that level makes me nervous sometimes as a person. Like, I tend to get self-conscious about it, and so I tried to really go out of my comfort zone and do it.
John said it was the most emotional you've been and your character.
Yeah, I think it deserved it, right? Like, I didn't want to, like, just phone it in and have it not be something, like, meaningful. I'm glad to hear that people think that I did a good job. I was hoping that I would
do a couple of people
a good job. But, yeah, I think it deserved it, and I tried my best to do that. And I think it's important to be honest and say, like, when it comes to role-playing those really serious emotional things, like, it's totally normal to be nervous and unsure and self-conscious and all those things. But I think just having a go at it, especially when you're at a table with people who are a similar vibe, like, nobody is shamed for having a go at it or trying to make it the best. Yeah, except Doug and his accents. But, like, just having a go at it and everybody's there for a good reason, want to make a good story, like, it makes it a little bit easier to do it.
All right. You may have a rest, Sam. Have a break. We'll focus on one of the other characters we've got here. Doug or Josh, you want to go? This is a few questions, so if you want to feel like talking, decide. Who wants next?
I'll have a crack unless you want
to
go.
All right, because I'm busting to the toilet, so I'll leave you for a few questions and I'll go for, and I'll come back.
All right, shotgun him.
All right, who we got?
Me.
All right, Doug, Dungeon Maestro asks, for Doug, you've had the most character deaths throughout the show. Do you feel that is because your characters take bigger risks, have the most YOLO attitude, or luck is against you? And on a follow-up question, how do you feel about the lethality or weighty consequences of Mothership as a system?
I think I'm going to go with the second one, the YOLO-like attitude. I try not to get too attached to characters because for me, one thing that I take very seriously is a death is a death. I felt really, really bad, and it's a bit of a sore point for me, was the whole Krezis incident and managing to make that work. I wouldn't say I take the biggest risks. I definitely put myself in the dumbest position. There are moments where I like to build, like, a glass cannon-y type character. I like to build characters with flaws. And to me...
And ceilings.
Yeah. And to me, death is still unending to a character. I don't need the happily ever after. I think Craig is the only character that actually has had a happily ever after of any of my characters.
That you've given the character, yeah.
Yeah. Craig getting a happy ending was weird. Yeah. I don't blame luck at all. At the end of the day, like, shit happens, but I think the only character that died from bad luck was the, not, was it, no, Goz was the other one. The Union boy from Bug Hunt, spoilers for Bug Hunt, who just opened up a car door and fucking exploded. Mm. I think that was the only bad luck death I've ever had. Apart from that, every death I had was very much it. Yeah. No, I love it. I don't hate it. I don't feel bad about it. I love my characters, and if they die, they die. And that's just their story.
Great. Dungeon Maestro asks, Josh, you got possibly the best loadout role a Marine can get with Rian. Tony started with almost nothing. Did you feel the difference in gear made a big impact in the way you played the two characters? Or what were you able to achieve in-game that is so dependent on resources your characters have at hand? Are you going to have a clipboard as starting equipment on the future characters?
Yeah, this is, I think, the main question that I unintentionally answered in the Discord.
Yeah, because you didn't read the memo.
I didn't read the memo, and then I got rid of it because I'd entered the Discord halfway through and didn't see the first bit that was like, we'll compile these and then we'll answer them at a later point. I think, if anything, the first Marine that I played, being Ukti, was already willing to get into a bit of a scuff and didn't have the best gear roll loadout that you could possibly get. It was just the marine attitude that I wanted to impart on the two characters. But I do feel like Rian had more like opportunities to have fun with a gun, sort of like if you're, you know, any kind of person that is handed a huge weapon and like gets to fire it. Like if you see, you can go online, you can look at people firing a 50 cal for the first time and they're like, oh, oh, oh. Like it's just one of those things where.
Feel a tingling deep in your balls.
Deep in you somewhere, you know. And so, you know, I feel like I still had the same marine energy, but a different form of leadership for Rian, but at the same time, tried to do what I could to recognize the fact that he had big, huge power armor and a fuck-off gun, and that would have been fun for any person to take into combat to some degree. As far as the resourcefulness of Tony, I feel like I wanted him to be resourceful regardless of his gear role. I mean, that's why I played him with the Italian accent. That's why I chose the Teamster, because I normally don't choose Teamsters. I wanted, like, I'm normally not an all-rounder kind of character. Like, I'll almost never play a bard because I just don't know how to make it work, even though plenty of people make bards do some incredible stuff in D&D. I felt like I would do just as poorly as a Teamster. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to play a Teamster. And Teamsters have to kind of rely on their handiness. So, you know, I want it to be some kind of like blue collar type situation. I thought New Yorker would be real fun. He rolled a book of grudges. So that's where the mafia spin came from as his icon. And yeah, he didn't roll great gear, but at the same time, he didn't really. Like his backstory was just not going to be a combat-based backstory anyway. I wanted him to be the engineer of the group. Like I wanted him to be someone that could take a set of tools and do something really cool with it.
Drill through the floor.
Drill through the floor, remove the door and create a fortress. You know, like the clipboard was just, I have no idea. I still don't understand where that came from. I think I literally just asked, is there a clipboard around here? And you're like, yeah, sure. I nail it to his head. The fuck? So, you know, he was able to have a lot of fun. And, you know, I really wanted to have a scene where I had, like, I don't think I even got to do it at the end, like the big laser cutter. I want to have a moment where he goes, and, like, just slams through something.
It is criminal. In the last 2 years, we haven't had a single laser cutter being fired in this whole game.
How many fucking laser cutters have we had? I think we've had one in 3 modules.
Yeah.
Not fired
like
one.
Like, the introductory scene when we go to the research base and they're looking at this big swing arm. He's like, oh, yeah, that's the Mark 2000. You know, it does, you know, it's really cool piece of gear.
Look at the cutter on that thing.
Yeah. Must be 250 at least. you know, like
the things I could do with that kind of machinery.
So I feel like if he had a really big gun, I don't think it really would have suited
him. Say hello to my little friend.
Yeah. I feel like if you were going to say hello to his little friend, it would be like a Gatling gun, like, but a Gatling nail gun.
I'll staple you to the fucking wall.
Check out this hardware.
Great. Good answers. What do we got? Throw in one from John. One for John. This is from CD again. They say, I have always wondered if John could just quote relevant scripture at every turn, or if he did some preparation to have a repertoire of things that might be relevant and then was very skilled at picking that from the repertoire in the moment. I'm versed enough that I could place most of his lines, but definitely couldn't have produced them at the speed he does. He's also kind of curious, or they're also kind of curious about those who have played Dungeons and Dragons. How would they characterize the different demands and expectations for players between the two systems? I confess I sometimes have felt what I consider D&D style play has crept into the show, maybe by design, ? But I'd like to hear players' perspective. Oh, I guess we have to talk about this as well. But John says, I am a religious man who went through seminary for 4 years in the early mornings, and I have an enthusiasm for biblical academia and mythology. I also, as a religious man, always have the scriptures handy on a device. So when I was playing Merkabah, I was basically constantly looking for any given biblical quote that I could apply to any situation. Those at the table can attest that I'd usually scramble on my Open Bible app. Generally, I know that content exists. Yeah. Josh is scrolling through his phone. Yeah, generally I know what context exists in what book, so I can just go searching through the chapter headings until I find it. I have such a good time playing Merkabah. I basically relished in these opportunities. I got giddy. But sadly, no, I do not recite them from memory. So he did have his app.
Yep.
And he could quickly, he knows enough to know where it is and he can search for it.
Okay, so I also went through theology college or whatever you call it. And you definitely, if you go through and study these things enough times, if there's a situation, you're like, oh, this would be perfect for that. Yeah. Like, there was a couple times where John pulled out something, I was like, I think I know what he's going to do. It's going to be great. So, I can definitely, you can always see when John's going through a scene and he's got, and he's like, he's got his iPad out. He's like scrolling through and he's like, okay, you can tell what he's doing. You can tell he's trying to pull out the perfect verse for that situation. And he does a great job.
Nails it every time.
Bravo. Cause it's all, most of it's in like that oldie English and I cannot.
Biblical language.
Yeah. I cannot fucking. Yes. I did that one time.
You struggle
time.
At the best of times.
Yeah. I did it that one time and I'm like trying not to stutter over every second word.
There are versions with more modern, verbiage.
Yeah, you know, yo.
Just in case you're wondering.
Hear it out, bitch. Yeah. Yo, as I go through.
That was bass.
As I step through the valley, the shadow man.
Yeah, yo, Jesus. Isn't that Jesus Christ Superstar?
Oh, no, it's done to death.
I don't know.
All right, yeah, he continues. In regards to Mosh versus D&D, the difference is pretty glaring, at least for me. I think if anything, Mosh has its roots closer to old school AD&D. This is because it's more OSR adjacent. In regards to the, you're not supposed to feel powerful. You're supposed to constantly feel lucky to be alive. Mm-hmm. It really is the difference between telling a long-spanning myth about some heroes on a quest and watching a sci-fi horror flick where everyone dies. He didn't say that. I added that inflection. This is back onto John. While D&D has some fear mechanics occasionally, like in Magic, all of Mosh's crunch is not whether you're hurt, but how hurt are you, which is reflected in the gameplay. Since I've never been a rules guy, I took pretty much naturally to Mosh. My passion is storytelling and immersion. It's a game where sometimes you fail on purpose, Sam, Tony, we've all done that, because it would make for a better movie or story. And just like the old Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, it's a bit of a character meat grinder with piles of character sheets at the ready to go, so you can roll up and out at short notice once you die. Of course, in our show, eventually some D&D tropes crawled their way in, especially in regards to the convoluted plans that rely on the fine print in the rules where the warden has to sort of do all the math in his head. I never felt confident enough as a rules player to try and pull something off along those lines. It's always been, oh, all right, I'm sick of this character now. Might as well kill them off, which has been my crutch more than once, tee-hee. Tee-hee being the joke there that Natalie has a bomb in it. Yeah. His chest.
And like also when we talk to John's level of immersion, he has rocked up in costume a couple times.
Oh yeah, cosplay.
More than once.
With instrument in hand.
Yeah.
The bard instrument.
Yeah, I think as far as things creeping in from D&D, you know, Mosh being more story-based and role-play-based, I would say the only times I would have noticed it is around the combat where, yeah, it's a very different combat system, don't get me wrong, but we've only ever really been used to that D&D style combat.
Yeah.
And with Mosh not being focused on combat, I think elements of that snuck in to fill gaps that we've just didn't really realize were there and we've just filled it in.
I think they're very separate in styles of play and you have to definitely switch between the two. It's a very drastic change, especially not rolling for everything.
Mm.
And you're not succeeding because you're rolling well. You're succeeding because you, the player, are thinking of things that outside the box or how to word things is more important than rolling a number and getting the higher number. sort of thing. Because that sort of, if you roll something high, you know how it's going to go. Mm. So you can say, okay, I've succeeded. I can do this. But yeah, that's all I have to say on that. Josh?
Look, I'm getting flashbacks to using the decanter of endless water to kill creatures.
Yeah.
Very non-D&D-esque, but also at the very same time, very D&D-esque. Like when you come to fantasy games, you find that if you're willing, you will have some really high ingenuity level gameplay and some opportunities for really good storytelling. It's up to you as the people at the table to decide on whether you want to drive story or success, or whether they might be the same thing. Yeah, it's sometimes it is a choice, but you know, you also don't want the game to end early, so you try and go for success at least half the time.
All right, very good questions from CD. I believe we've touched on that. What else have we got? Anything else to add on that? I don't think so. I think D&D style play is still, we all like D&D, so if it has crept in, it's because...
I think it hasn't so much that it's crept in as the fact that D&D is the more popular mainstream pen and paper game. Like, you'll find every game, if you look at it with that lens of D&D, you'll find a lot of D&D in absolutely everything.
Yeah.
But then D&D itself has has used elements and keys from millions of other things.
I think also how we played the campaign by leaning towards raw, rules of written. If it's not written down and we have to all make it up, it's more confusing because we can't just point to something and saying, this is how it will work.
They're both role-play fantasy games with math. At the end of the day, there are definitely going to be similar elements.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right, moving on. This one's from Goody Sand Shoes. Yeah. Good name there. For Andrew, how much info about Monarch and the Minotaur did you give John beforehand for MK Merkaba's character arc? Zero.
Yeah, it's insane.
Zero. John is good. And I didn't need to give him any information, not that I would want to, unless he approached me specifically saying, hey, could I learn a bit more about this, or would I know something about this so I can plan that? Don't need it. We both riff off each other. Basically, the scene with the yellow goo at the end, I didn't know he was going to do that. That was broached between us. Or maybe what sort of token could he have had from that adventure? And I had suggested before the campaign started, what if he had a piece of the yellow goo? Like just as a, I was thinking just as a little callback, but he took that, put it in his chest and had it as a focal point of this extra entity. You know, it all evolved from that. And as we went into that, I just sort of jumped in with the computer's voice. And then we turned it into, during the moment, this isn't the computer, this is you. This is Merkaba connecting with this thing. It was just great to happen in the moment. But no, all of that stuff just happened organically. It was very good. Moving on. Also, for John, there's a question from Dungeon Maestro again. For John, what things have you learned in all Mothership you've played so far that informs how you design and write your own adventures and material? This is for John specifically. He's written two adventures now that Sam and I have played. We've been there for both. No,
I wasn't there
I've been there for both.
Narcissus.
Yeah. Yeah, it's only me that's been there for both.
Oh, wow.
The rest of...
been for Narcissus. I didn't even know you wrote a second one.
Because you don't listen to the Discord.
Sorry, I'm pretty bad.
Anyway, he says, that's a good question. I think the main lesson that I learned playing Mosh games is that translated to making some one-shots is the following. One, make the players feel small. This is absolutely key. Nothing kills the vibe of a Mosh game more than making the players feel powerful. However, it is allowed to happen occasionally. Two, don't assume the players want to be scared. You need to bring most of that yourself. This is especially true in Doug's case. Doug has to buy into the adventure and he will bring it, but only if it's if he's feeling those feelings and can dive into it.
Yeah, I struggle with horror because I don't find horror horrifying.
Yes. Owing to various styles of gameplay, you might have a player who's playing up the horror stuff, but most people play games to play games. If you want to run a Mosh game, I'd recommend being enthusiastic about immersion and horror yourself. So that, I guess, he means putting them into the scene and making sure you lead them into it, sort of thing, rather than just saying, you're scared, you're in a ship.
Yeah.
It's a bit harder. You sort of, and John does this by building the world around it and slowly dropping you in, yeah, I think.
It's the moments where you walk into a bathroom, see a cricket with a man's face, yeah, and you're just yeah. like, that is genuinely creepy. Oh, and yeah. I love it.
Number three, draw from everywhere. Nothing is new under the sun. In Mosh, I find the goal is not try to make something unique. It's the opposite. The joy in the craft comes, at least for me, is mastering the parameters of a genre and imitating them well. I don't want something that feels like a Mosh game. I want something that feels like a movie, which is my sentiments exactly. The Mothership Cypher Horror RPG is a movie. I believe you are playing your favorite movies. You're playing Alien. You're playing The Thing. You're playing Event Horizon. And it does that exceptionally well. And I believe if you, that means making the characters larger than life. They've got one-liners. They do stupid shit, which people do in horror movies all the time, to push the story along. Because someone does die when they walk into a corridor.
Yeah.
It's great.
That's the one thing I like. That's the one thing I really, really actually did enjoy about Mosh is you need to take away like the living in the fantasy and just go, this is a movie and you're yelling at the TV, but this time the character actually moves when yeah. you yell at him.
Yeah.
Like live it.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Number four, devise a climax. This is a continuation of the previous point, but I made a definite points about my adventures to have twists or reveals that manifest into a climactic boss fight with disturbing imagery. So that's what I mentioned before, that he builds it so it's a descent or slowly feeds you into something more horrific and then a big extravaganza at the end. Is that what we experienced, Sam?
Yep.
Definitely. Fifth, this is the most important one and the final one. Plan for it to end wherever it needs to end, wherever it needs to end. Your players will go at a pace that you cannot always predict. If you want your game to run well, you need to design multiple endpoints that would all serve as a satisfying ending that doesn't hinge on everything them getting what you hoped they would go to. Like, yeah, the lights turned off, everyone's staring. It's pretty dark and moody in here. I should turn on that side light. Anyway, where was I? Yeah, if you want your game to run well, you need to design multiple endpoints that would all serve as a satisfying ending and doesn't hinge on everything them getting where you wanted them to. Design and account for multiple paths if you can. The perfect design Mosh zine should be written in such a way that it can be last paced, action-packed gore fest or a slow burn, creeping dread affair. If your heart is set on one or the other, you'll need to make that clear to your players above table or in exposition or whatever. When I ran his first one regarding silence, they went far quicker than I expected than when I ran my second one. They went slower. But luckily, I had enough space to adjust to both play styles. So Silence and Narcissus, we went quicker than he expected. Who's that?
If you speak into the microphone, they don't hear you any better.
Who goes there?
Who's that?
Yes, that's it for John, and that's for Dungeon Maestro's question for John. Let's go down a bit along the list for someone else, shall we?
Writing is hard, like writing a module.
Oh, yeah.
I thought it'd be easy.
I'm not good at writing modules from scratch. But sorry, my children are barging in. Writing. I think I'm okay, but when I'm given something as a framework, I'm good at building on top of that, as you saw from Neverwinter campaign sourcebook, most of these things are paragraphs, Doug, and the amount of stuff we got out of that is huge.
Massive.
So I think I'm good at, and Gradient Descent, it's just a big old dungeon with no narrative.
Just
you have to make the narrative. You have to seed the thing with characters. Like, there's no divers. There's Arcady on the bell. There's Noriko. There's Ghost Eater. And who's the other NPC on board the deep?
The guy duct taped to a wall.
No, that was an invented one, surely.
Oh,
Simco.
He was inside.
There was
the map maker.
Ghostface.
Yeah, Ghost Eater. Arcady, Noriko. That's it.
Terrifying fucking photos, by the way.
That's all they give you.
Holy crap.
Everyone else is from me. Every character.
Yeah.
And all their stories connect, all the things connected to it. When they say you see a diver, in the book it's just got diver, wounds one, may have a weapon, roll a d10. Commander Kilroy, Rachel Kilroy was the commander of the troubleshooters. I believe I mentioned her in name. Commander Kilroy, But other than that, there are a few unique things. Obviously, the Fallen King, things like that. He's introduced in the adventure. There are a few other NPCs inside. But the Chosen are just Chosen. The Fallen are just Fallen.
This is why DM tables give you literal lists of names for different races and areas and stuff.
Yeah.
And then you just create NPCs prehab if you need to.
Yeah, this
you can't
is,
just drop them on the fly.
This is how I built Simcoe. Where are you? Forgotten Androids. Roll D10 for manufacturing defect. What did I roll?
Is Simcoe not a prefab?
He's mine.
Oh, wow. I thought he was actually a thing.
So I made some Forgotten Androids. One was roll a D10, got a zero. Pseudo flesh rotted off completely. A walking metal skeleton. Claw-like fingers and toes. Climbs on walls and ceilings. Forearms sharpens into blades. Horrific. Then I rolled, what are they doing? A D10.
Selling shit in a shop.
Where are we?
Grocery store clerk.
I love those juxtaposing like...
Seven, things. Running a small barter shop. Yeah. They have some weapons and ammunition. They want logic cores. They have a backup nearby. That's him. Everything else came from that. There was another guy called Mr. Hyde, who is a forgotten android whose face is absent entirely, been ripped off, can't see perhaps, no optical senses, and someone has... shoved over him strobing lamps. So I called him Mr. Hyde because he would always try to hide from things, but you just saw this strobing lamps everywhere you go, and it was like a joke. Yeah. Like people, like you go to talk to divers, if you did small chat, small talk, they'll be like, oh yeah, if you see this guy, just have a laugh because it's like this strobing guy.
Mr. Hyde.
Yeah, that was funny. But anyway, where was I? We'll move on. Dungeon Meister asked for everyone, what class have you enjoyed playing the most? Are there classes or character archetypes you haven't had a chance to play yet in Mosh? Josh?
I've played them all. In fact, that's how I ended up with Tony, is because I hadn't played the Teamster.
The last one.
I avoided it. I played a couple of the classes a couple times. So I played a scientist a couple times. I'd played an android and I'd played a couple marines. So I would say... Tony, character-wise, was a really fun character to play. In terms of actual build, unremarkable, in my opinion, as far as like our favorite thing about the Teamster, nothing that really makes me go, that's amazing.
I think in general, their stats are much higher. They're robust.
They have an all-round higher level. So it's really hard to find a huge weakness in them because... they are just above average all around. So in that regard, really good, and they're guaranteed at least a couple skills, which is great. However, the scientists, I really enjoy having the scientists really high intellect, for
more
example.
Specialized, you can choose
more specialized,
much
yeah.
broader range.
And so I really enjoyed playing the scientists from like being the, you know, the squib with the behind the glasses and all of that. And, you know, the Marine is pretty typical of your, you know, fighter, paladin, you know, strong arm class. And the android, I think, is a lot of fun for the potential for narrative because...
the variety of androids you could have.
You could be the pleasure bot if you really wanted to. Or you could be a clerk, you know, just designed to crunch numbers. Or you could be a combat robot or you know, you could really draw any kind of inspiration you want. But I really, really like the narrative aspects that the android forces upon itself. Like you don't necessarily have, it does give you a bit of a crutch to fall on, but the fact that you inspire disadvantage on fear saves for anyone that's around you, great, great bit of fun. Yeah,
so much fun.
So yeah, I really enjoy the narrative that's forced on androids. I really enjoy the robust nature of Marines and being able to be okay, brainish. And, you know, yeah, I guess that if I think that answers it.
Yeah. You know. John says, I think it's clear that I enjoy playing androids. He's the most android heavy person at the table. And the reason for that is that simply it's easier and to realistically characterize an android without it seeming silly. As you said, you can make them anything. You can add eccentricity and odd quirks and catchphrases, that all fun stuff, without lowering the tone as much as you might if you were trying to devise a human character. you can't make them as ridiculous or as
like
set.
Natalie, yeah.
Like Natalie, you can't, definitely can't do that. And without being like a gimmick. Also, as someone who has run games, I just enjoy the possibilities of both world building and horror that come from playing an android. Being the person that creeps other people out is incredibly gratifying power in a horror game, meaning the fear checks. He also finds it gratifying that he even tried it with some of his humans, Eli Darko and Charlie Valentine, trying to make other human characters uneasy, which I think he did. And I think he thinks his time playing Mosh, he sort of missed his shot to make a prototypical Marine tough nut. If I get to play again, I might give it a go, he says. Sam?
I think I played them all. But the androids in
homeostasis. You know, I've captured all the times we say homeostasis.
Yeah.
And at the end of episode 3, it's just played.
That's brilliant.
And it's just homeostasis. Homeostasis. Welcome to homeostasis.
In terms of like which one I like the best, it really depends on the situation. I haven't disliked any of the classes that I've played, and it seems like relevant and applicable to the time that I was playing them. So I don't really see any like enormous benefit or drawback to any particular one. And I think when we started with the one shots, randomly rolling for that kind of helped with that because I wasn't super invested or tied up in what class it was going to be. So yeah, I like them all. I haven't found any part of it that I don't like.
Yeah, I think the flowchart style character sheet, rolling for your equipment, your patch, your trinket, in 15 minutes you get the character you're going to play. It's just surprising. And you want to play that character to see how they go. And I think because of the fun characters we've had just out of the random rolls have been great. So definitely. Doug?
I never got to play Android.
No.
Which is a bummer because Androids look like so much fun. Next time I come back to play Mosh, Android, 100%.
Yep, do it.
100%. As for the other three, I think Scientists was probably my favorite. Like, both characters I've had the most fun with were the Scientists.
Figures you would like the characters that know everything.
Actually, yeah. Actually, I think it's all three of my characters because I'm pretty sure the Noble was a kitbash for Scientists for Empress.
Lordling, yeah.
Yeah, Lordling. Great class, by the way. Yeah, and I feel like Android is going to heighten the parts of Scientist that I love the most, which is why I'm surprised I never played an Android. But, yeah.
Yeah, I think the next time we play, I think it's better having Androids if you guys want to make a particular Android. We won't be limited having the mathematics and linguistics skills. Just tell me what Android you would like to make, and we'll sort of make it like a combat version.
Yeah.
Or a service version or a science bot or something built to a particular purpose. Because having an android in the crew has definitely made things interesting. Yeah, so that's what we have. Dungeon Maestro, moving on.
I mean, okay, just last point.
Yeah, go for it.
So there was a point where I was playing a scientist and John was playing an android, and we had a really good moment where the scientist was a cybernetics expert and had used that to try and repair John after it was having like a mental or CPU breakdown, meltdown.
That was Zachary Doppler.
And I thought that narratively, like, I wasn't expecting that to be a kind of thing where the two characters would interact that way. So I think the classes do offer really interesting ways that they can interact as well.
Yeah.
That was something I enjoyed.
I did John's, didn't I? Yep. This is from Ember to the whole cast. Who was the hardest of your PC or NPCs to roleplay and why? Most difficult character to roleplay or NPC?
Failure.
Failure is a character from Ghosts of Gauntgrim, which is a side character who was played a few times in the middle of the campaign, season 2 and 3, perhaps he showed up.
Yeah. I think Failure and, mechanically speaking, Ark as well, I struggled with.
Failure was a spell sword.
Spellblade.
Blade Singer.
I loved Failure. I loved him. Like, his whole layout was fun. But A, I suck at French accents. And B, Failure was a dick. And I'm not very good at being a dick.
Unless we're talking about the layout of the ship.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Then it comes easy.
Then it comes easy. Or talking about fucking flash bombs.
Then the dick comes easy.
Yeah, it does.
That's what they always say.
Josh, who is the hardest PC to play and or NPC? To role play, not just to play.
Simon Burr, I had a clear vision that went straight out the window.
Because he wasn't an android. He said, I want to play an android. You wake up, you're not an android.
Yeah, I wake the moment that he wakes up, he's something else. And then I'm like, I don't know what to do anymore. But also just like some of the conversations had led me in a different direction and ADHD be killing y'all. Doug knows what I'm talking about. Same thing kind of happened with Prodonis from, I can't remember.
Oh, fuck.
That we should not name. The Haunt.
Yeah. And like, I think he had a good potential, but the fact that the silliness was like compounded.
This is another Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah.
Product we have made called The Haunt, where we play The Haunt, which is a
where we play The Haunt. And it still haunts us to this day. The Prodonis was a character that was actually meant to be like the brother of another character that I had created.
Yeah, we know the story. Yeah. Move on. Mothership.
Give me a second. But it was just that the first introductory moments had kind of thrown me off. And so it was a similar thing for Simon. I think I just got carried away with some of the elements that were introduced from being knocked the F out and then waking up that I didn't really stick to the story that I'd written for that character. I enjoyed Simon Burr, but I did find him difficult to play because I found myself continuously trying to bring him back to what I'd originally intended.
Sam? Sorry, Doug?
I was going to say, that's very similar to what I had with Ark as well. Like, I built Ark for a very specific idea and then ended up taking him completely the wrong direction.
Yeah, and then ended up casting a spell on someone while invisible.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Sam.
Yeah, I think sometimes I avoid that because of what I mentioned. Like, I don't try to pre-plan so much, so then I don't feel like I have to drive the character in a direction that might be not quite in line with where we're currently heading. But I think the hardest part was, like I spoke about it earlier, was just the change in tone for Dr. Elias, really, and making it not seem naff to me, which, like, I'm the harshest critic of myself. So I think that was probably the most difficult. Otherwise, like...
Listening back, since you've got the opportunity, is how did you think, would you rate yourself?
Oh, look... I'm probably not the best person to rate myself on it because I hear the things in it that I might, I don't know, I judge myself more harshly than what other people will probably judge me.
Yeah.
I think I did pretty well. I think with more practice and kind of like putting myself out there, it's so funny because I was having a conversation with Stephen, my partner, earlier today where I said, sometimes I feel like I'm a better DM than I am a player because it flows a lot easier to me to improvise from that perspective than it does when I'm a player. So it just happens a lot more naturally.
Yeah, as a player, that's all you have to go off.
Yeah.
As a DM, something doesn't work, you can move on to another character, another situation.
Yeah, you figure it out. And I think understanding the context and having the framework for where things are heading allows me to sort of improvise within that and not worry about it. And I don't have to worry about it so much because the whole goal is to make something that's fun for the people around you. It's not so much that you're the focus of what's happening. It's that you're just like putting the building blocks in place for everybody else to build on. So yeah, I think I did pretty well, but I would like to get more comfortable with that sort of like more emotional, in-depth role play. Definitely.
Yeah, would you feel comfortable forcing yourself out of your comfort zone and doing more emotive accents, voices, things like
that?
Oh, you're
not
comfortable.
I struggle with that. Yeah. Even as a DM, I struggle with that. And I focus on cadence and like vocabulary instead of accents.
Yeah.
Because I find them difficult to maintain. And it's also that like self-conscious part of my brain where I'm like, it's going to sound like shit if you do that. Like, don't do that. You're going to sound like an idiot. So I try to focus on that like cadence and vocab aspect instead. It's definitely a key part of it. And if I force myself to do it, I'd get more comfortable with the idea.
Yeah.
And that would also flow into what we're talking about now, which is like that character development, like more emotive context as part of the game. So I think it would definitely help. But that's just something that I personally struggle with, and I'm trying to like broaden my horizons in that aspect.
Yeah. Doug, you did your hardest one? Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was mine?
I think for me, yeah, failure was definitely hard for the same reasons you were saying. It's very much a character that I don't.
All right, we've done you. Don't Let's know. Move on.
Yeah.
My hardest PC or NPC. I haven't had many PCs, obviously.
That's what's hard for Andrew, is that you didn't play enough PCs.
I think Raphael, just a pleasure to play, very easy playing Raphael.
Supposed to be the hardest, Andrew.
I know. That's why I'm knocking them out. The doctor, the scientist, play the physicist, Evelyn, pretty basic. I think I could play her, not very hard. Rudy, pleasure to play, fine. Arcady, loved playing Arcady. Love those types of characters. The wise, exposition-giving person. I love giving dialogue and exposition through a character. It's much more interesting. And Noriko, it was hard doing Noriko because I didn't know how to approach her. But I think I did well with Noriko, making her a bit, the word? A bit wide-eyed and slightly off, slightly too fanatical or such. Or
I mean, I thought Noriko was probably one of my favorite characters on the bell.
Yeah?
Yeah. Mm. I liked Noriko.
Yeah. Ghost Eater, didn't get much chance to play him, but we're just limited by our time. We could have had whole scenes with Ghost Eater. Unfortunately, we couldn't, but that's fine. Hardest character NPC was to Marcus Soledek. Everything built up to the last two episodes, and I had to roleplay him. How do I get across? Doug, stop fiddling. I can hear all that. I had to get across, you know, what are you expecting from this person? Big bad villain. It's just not what he was about. He was just a normal dude. He didn't have much time to have this huge plan. He was winging it as much as he could. So yeah, that was hard to come across as still being someone you could sympathize with. You guys could have definitely joined in his quest. Merkaba was willing to offer himself up as going along with it and trying to destroy Monarch, because that's what he wanted to try to do as well. But yeah, Marcus Ledeck. For Andrew and John, what advice would you give to the first-time warden who is planning to run Mosh zines somewhere in the future? I think John has answered this in his regards to writing a Mosh game. But in regards to question one from Ember, over all the Mosh games, this is from John, over all the Mosh games, probably when I ran Silence, I was controlling Otto's Viahander. Frankly, I think I totally botched him when I think how I actually played him compared to what it was in my head. I think his NPC chops improved a lot by the time I ran my second one-shot, Homeostasis, which is really good character work from John, because he had a lot more characters to deal with, definitely. And in the campaign, he found Gordon much harder to roleplay than Merkaba, merely because there's only so much times you can roleplay a guy being afraid and freaked out before it gets repetitive. And his big mouth refuses to let me be quiet. It was harder to work out what his character arc was, whereas Merkaba seemed most designed to bloom or boom in Gradient Descent campaign, being the android, god-fearing,
explosive personality.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, that's all of us answered that question. Let's loop back around. Dungeon Maestro, again, for anyone, if you were adding a custom skill to the Mosh character sheet, what have you found to be something lacking in the official options? Josh, because Doug, I've asked you every time.
Let's go to someone else because I need to think about that one.
Sam.
I don't know. I feel like it makes sense. It's so open. It's like using the mysticism skill to cross your fingers to aim better with the gun. Most things are applicable to most situations if you can just kind of explain your intent and how it is you're going to use the skill. So I think if we add more things to it, we're going to start heading into D&D territory where everything's listed as a skill. So
good point. Yeah.
I think having it broad like that helps you apply it to your specific needs and have it be more flexible. So I don't think I would add anything.
Good answer. I can't think of anything I would be adding. Maybe criminal?
Mm.
I think maybe something that's taking advantage of other people, as in for their detriment.
Well, Tony kind of used his Rimwise for that.
Yeah, that's what Rimwise is, isn't it?
No, Rimwise, it's not intended to be criminality. It's intended to be on...
Rimwise could be criminal or survival based. It's really how you choose to play it.
Rimwise is that sort of...
It's culture and knowledge. You know, let me read it specifically to see if I can give us insight.
I think the criminality part really has to be a choice at the end of it, and your success on it is based on how skillful you are at what you're trying to do to someone else's detriment.
So Rimwise says the practical knowledge and know-how regarding Outer Rim colonies, their customs, and the seedier parts of the galaxy. So I guess, but that could also mean...
It's like being able to identify the... Space Thieves Guild.
Like street smart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I would add bureaucracy. Like, whether it be government or corporate, doesn't matter. You can make a whole tree out of that.
Yeah.
But, like, the ability to navigate.
I feel like they had something like that as well, though, didn't they?
I can't see it. And like, yeah, it's a good one.
And you can end up with, like, lawyer type shit. Like, building a very, especially for, like, your bureaucratic android characters, which seem to pop up.
Yeah. VIPs.
Bureaucracy.
Great. All right. What else have we got here?
Did you think of something, Josh?
I mean, look, I think because it lets you be pretty flexible with each of the skills, it does. I think that's what makes it hard to figure out what I would want to add. Like, I was thinking, like, fabrication, like, technically you've got jury rigging, but that's not, you're not necessarily just making something that already is something that you would have to be able to make.
Engineering.
You're improvising, you know?
Engineering, design, building, and use of engines, machines, and structures.
But what if it's not a machine, engine, or structure that you're trying to fabricate? Do you know what I mean? Like a piece of armor, for example, isn't something that you just...
An object, clothing.
Yeah.
Seamstress.
There's no embroidery skills, you know? There's no forgery kit. You kind of have to... decide or what fits the closest. So I think that bit does make it more difficult in a way, but I think it is flexible enough that it will forgive you for not using something that's specifically that.
Yeah, I think talk to your warden and see what skill you can apply to.
Yeah.
What skills that are there to apply, or just don't need a role. Don't need a role for skills. It's mostly what you can explain you want to do.
You can even just change it from jury rigging to like fixing and creating.
Yeah. Or even better, or something like that. As a character, you go down to the district and pay someone else to do it for you to design it. That's what your disposable income, because having power in this game is not being a superhero. You might just have a lot of cash where you can just outsource, have lots of goons.
I think cash. Which means completing at least one mission.
Without dying.
Yeah.
I think cash is the power scaling of this game.
Which is most like normal people in the real world. Cash, money is power. You know?
In comes Tony Robbins.
All right.
You too could be rich.
We'll round out with some broader questions. Two more questions to go. This is from Chris on Patreon. After running Mothership as a series of one-shots and then transitioning into a campaign, do you feel like Mothership supports campaign play? I have personally had doubts myself, but I have thus far only run it as a one-shot, and I'm curious how this experience might have changed how you feel about the system and its potential. Could you see yourselves continuing on with this cast of characters indefinitely?
Yeah, I'll go back and re-listen to Gradient Descent.
I'll be honest, at first I was in the same boat. I did not think you could, like, it wouldn't be a campaign in the traditional sense, but
it was brilliant,
and I wholly believe, like I said, there's no level-based system like D&D. Like, there is, you can train skills and stuff, but there's no
progression in the adventure you're playing.
So progression feels more organic, and as you grow with your, like, your money, your items, your skills, you're also racking on injuries, you're also racking on stresses, and your character's growing both like positively and negatively. And I think there's so much potential for a campaign.
I remember before we started playing Gradient Descent and we were thinking, what are we going to do for a long form Mothership content? And I was throwing out some just, you know, meme ideas. Basically.
Shitty ideas.
They were not shitty.
John and I just balked at.
No.
In private.
I don't believe it.
In private.
John, to say it isn't so. But the when I was, you know, posting these, I was thinking in the background, I was like, look, really, it's just down to how much time you're willing to put into the story itself. Like, if you want to play a one-shot, it's because you probably only have the time or patience to do a one-shot, whereas a campaign, you naturally have to invest more time into it. So any story can go for longer if you really want it to.
Yeah.
It's just about how you structure things together. Are you going to have one big loud bang, or are you going to have it slowly burn through the story?
Another idea is you can spin it around a little bit, especially something like Gradient Descent, where you've got the mission area and the bell, which is like a hub world. You can do like a Westmarch format,
mm-hmm,
and have multiple players and multiple characters, which fits in well with Mothership's die, make new character sort of feel. It's like that whole Westmarch vibe, you know, like that'll be a really good way of playing for Mothership, I find.
Sam, thoughts?
Sometimes I feel like the one-shot format happens because not so much, it can be based around time and energy, but I think sometimes when you play a lot of like TTRPG and you do campaign-based stuff, the one-shot comes in and is an opportunity for like, it's low stakes. It's high stakes because it's Mothership, but it's low stakes because you don't have to worry about the ongoing impact of your choices as a character and what's going to happen with the greater story in, you know, all of that comes with a campaign. So sometimes it's just kind of like a breath of fresh air to be like, okay, I'm going to play something that I have never played before. I've wanted to try this. Like, I don't have to worry about, quote unquote, ruining the game for myself or others because I've been blasé with my decision making in the campaign. The campaign itself is more of a high stakes format. Like I said, it's Mothership, so it's high stakes anyway, but it's higher stakes because it's this ongoing process and we're outside of just the single session. So I think it works. It does work both ways. I think the one-shot format is a really good way to get started. And I think that's what helped me is, like, I didn't have to worry about going in and jumping into a campaign straight away and being like, every decision matters because, like, this all hinges on it being successful and I'm here playing for, like, however long I'm playing for and I need my character to last the distance and all that. Instead, it was, like, that introduction where it was fun and, like, still that high stakes was there in terms of the one shot and making, like, not wanting to die and wanting to do the mission and all that. But like I think it translated well over to the campaign. So if I was going to suggest to anybody to do it, to start with the one shots.
Mm. Yeah. I think most people who come into Mothership for the first time will be because they've had an off day. Someone's away from their normal game. They throw in the one shot of this system and it is going to be a bit of a stretch to turn it into a campaign to get someone to want to play it for a campaign because you will have to change your format slightly. I think the attitude is different a lot if you're knowing.
I mean, looking at the way you built the story that we had, you had both A Pound of Flesh, Gradient Descent, like the different modules all being a part of the same story, and they blended in well together that you could probably just go back and finish Pound of Flesh
100%.
On Prospero's Dream if you really wanted to. That would be a viable option. And then you could still, you know, if you had enough sway to get a new, get someone to let you back into the deep, if you really wanted to do that, you could explore the other levels. Like there are ways that you can go and find other ways to expand on the story. And I'm sure there are other modules. I mean, you could turn Ypsilon into we need more resources. What can we do? Well, there's this mission where they just need us to transport some gear from this station to that mining base that's over there. And turns out there's a yellow group monster.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, a lot of people have used Ypsilon as their first one and then turning that into a campaign, which we've done sort of as well. We did this with taking a previous adventure, taking those characters into a more campaignable setting.
Yeah, and like what Sam was saying is the stakes are so much higher with campaigning in a game like Mothership where the stakes are already so high. Something as simple as go into this building and kill this robot computer turns into what can be years.
Well, that wasn't even your mission.
Yeah.
Yeah, nothing to do with it.
Because it's such a, you're not going to go in like an average D&D party where you can go in, wipe out the boss and leave. You're going to go in, you're going to be slow, you're going to be methodical, it's going to take time. You're going to do it over several long periods of time. It's going to take a while. It's not all going to get done. Like Gauntlegrim which I think, what, it happened in 2 months, not even a month and a half.
I think all up from where we started, it was 4 to 4.5 months was the total span of the 2.5 year campaign we played.
Yeah.
All that time was only 4 months max in game time.
Versus something like Mothership, which will not only take physically you and your party
years, you would play them over years.
And then the characters themselves, probably the same length of time.
I mean, a good 60% was spent in the cavern.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
The Dark Lake.
I think going back to Mothership, especially with this campaign, what I wanted to do, because I was having doubts it could be ran as a campaign, especially our bread and butter was one shots, very particular formats and time constraints. I said, how do I structure it? How do we get that conflict? Because you can't fight monsters every episode. So how do you get this conflict and the interest and the stakes? You need to get people to care about the characters. If you need to make the players care about the characters, otherwise the horror is meaningless.
And you needed a ripcord that would work in the event that we went so long that John was leaving.
Yeah, that too. But any game you play, there's always something hanging over where it's imminent that things are going to happen, where holidays, people got real lives to do. So it's really good to have that sort of, we'll get as much done as we can in this time. I enjoy having that time limit because we tell better stories with it, I think. I think the attitude of doing a campaign play was to still have to do scenes where once the characters are there, each scene has to have a goal. You need to start at one place and finish at another. You can't just have scenes for scene, like you can't just have things happen for just filling in time. And I think we did that. Most of the scenes we had were definitely push the story along, had conflict, like Dutch pulling his weapon on everyone is an encounter where you have to resolve the conflict and then you defuse the situation and pull back. And you've got that time to have it develop over a long period of time and make you look forward to the time you're going in the deep. Like just before you're on that shuttle, you've just had all this time traveling. You've talked to Arcady. You've had episodes and episodes. On the third time we play, we're going into the deep. It's just, I love that feeling saying, this whole 4 hours we're playing is we're going to do this dungeon. And it's just, that's great. Like, that's when the stakes rise up. That's when you don't want to lose these characters and it makes so much of a difference. So I think if you go into it with that attitude, you're going to make the characters have a reason to not want to die straight away. I think it works.
With Gradient especially, like the act of going into the dungeon alone, you can feel the impact of what you're doing.
Yeah.
You can physically go, this isn't a small thing. This isn't just going to be a quick jump in, look at something and jump out. This is going to be life or death.
That's what I wanted to say. I wanted to do something different with preparing for this campaign. Instead of preparing all this stuff and having to write things for D&D, I wanted to just run off this book and not have to plan stuff. So, because there's a storytelling method where I like to use is, if something doesn't happen in that scene, move it along, but then next time flash back and elaborate on it. You don't have to think in the moment. We can go have all these little time. We can play with the time. You can play with the format. You guys going to Megara Grimm and asking about this other team, I didn't plan another team. I went with you guys to have a team, which end up being the whole adventure was around this team and this thing. I said, yeah, they would have had another team. Here it is. We'll flash back to you talking about it. Here's more elaboration on it for you guys. Because this campaign could have followed the players anywhere. You could have said, I want to go to engineering. I want to look for artifacts. I want to just find as many artifacts as we can. Who cares about this other team? It could have gone so many different ways and think that the campaign goes where the players want to, you want to take it. So you've got to follow you guys and sort of put out little feelers of things. Oh, you really latch onto this or you latch onto that. You could have killed Harper Kerensky straight away, said he's an infiltrator, we're not taking him back, left him in the deep. That would have been okay. They don't care about it. You might have explored hell. You might have gone all these cool places. So there's
so much.
There's so much. And John finishes on that. John says, Mosh absolutely works as a campaign game. You just need to adjust your expectations and play cautiously, not murder hoboing in this game. But since Mosh is usually made up of mostly atmosphere and a couple of encounters per session, you can definitely make it work. And so long as you lean into the psychological aspects of the character arcs, you can develop and have fun. The character arcs you can develop and have fun with are truly phenomenal.
We could have gone in and just tried to mow down as many chosen or fallen as possible.
Oh, yeah.
It would have had consequences, though.
Definitely.
Yeah, I think another...
You could have joined Marcus, and that would have been the campaign finishing on that big fight, the big battle within the Eden.
I think another thing as well is we're very, like us as a table in general, for the most part, love our combat. I won't speak for everyone.
I love combat in general.
I know a lot of people love combat. And, like, we put a lot of combat into things because we enjoy it. I know of people that run entire games without combat. So
I would die. I would literally wither and die.
So like, I think the biggest consequence to Mothership is getting into a fight, and it punishes you for it. We love that punishment because we love the combat. So
I want
really
to build up the feeling of your character and liking it, and finally liking your character and throwing that feeling into imminent death, and just to be on nervous about losing or not, like Gordon fighting Armand. Those roles were down to the wire. He freaking, two wounds he took, he could have died, 30% chance per time he was dead.
Yeah, he would
instantly
have been screwed.
Yeah.
So that's what I wanted to get to. And because you care about Gordon so much, because of all these scenes, it just makes it so much better than a throwaway character. I'll just continue on with John because we've got 10 minutes. John has never had so much fun in this campaign, especially when it comes to negative character arcs, which is just such a delicious can of worms, he says. Meaning, you're getting the fun out of failing.
Mm.
That's what Mothership's about. It's seeing how the character devolves as you go. You start good and get worse. And you need to sort of come to terms with that. It's going to happen.
Mm.
If he had the chance to play in a Mosh campaign again once he got home, he'd do it in a heartbeat. But of course, you need the right material to carry you. Selecting good adventures is good. Connecting them together. He also says, however, I think that the one or two shots are still bread and butter of the game. And he certainly missed them when we were running Gradient Descent. That feeling of potential where you don't know what you're going to end up with when you look at a blank character sheet, for him, was one of the best parts of every session and should not be ignored. A good Netflix series is great, but movies are great too. One last question. Unless anyone wants to elaborate on the campaign play? No one? Yeah. It works as a campaign.
It does.
Chris, yeah.
To answer your question.
Yes. Finally to me, and I'll open this up to you as the last question. This is from Legato. For Andrew, what are some lessons learned about running a Mothership as a campaign link scenario versus one-shots, things you have done differently now you've reached the end? Prep, house rules, etc. Preparation, I think, was great, having the freedom and not having to sit and write things out. Rolling everything mostly random that I wanted to, and actually deciding that it doesn't have to go by the rules. It has to go by my enjoyment of seeing you react to random things and me surprising myself sometimes. Sometimes I chose which artifacts would fit. Sometimes I rolled randomly myself. Other times you guys rolled randomly. But that was good to know. I got lots of enjoyment out of that, plenty of surprises. Resolve, I think I mentioned this before. I would have resolve just every, your high score, every session we played, every episode perhaps, you get to use it once.
Mm.
So that promotes you guys getting, use it. Oh, the episode's nearly finished. Use your resolve. So that would have been better. And I think other than that, house rules, we didn't have much house rules or things we changed. Do you recall any?
No, not really.
Off the top of my head, I think there might have been one, but I don't remember what it was. I think we had house rules right at the start when it was playtest stuff.
Hmm.
I think there were a couple that we ended up when the rules actually came in.
Yeah.
But apart from that, I don't think we had any house rules.
I like playing it as vanilla as possible, so yeah. I think we did that with most of the things. I think we interpreted the panic effects rather well with our conditions. We did house rule a few things with the cowardice. It goes, okay, once you're in an encounter, you've sort of gotten over your fear, one roll for that. Doug, and then you don't have to roll it every time you want to shoot something.
Yeah.
So that was one thing we did. Final thoughts?
I think from what I'm sort of getting is there's a lot of you guys are not scared, but like
apprehensive
about wardening a game, I would say don't be intimidated by it at all. Like, Mothership is actually, as someone who's GM'd a few different systems, Mothership has actually been the easiest one that I've ever, next to like Avatar Legends, which has like three rules in it.
Yeah.
Mothership has been one of the easiest systems I've ever wardened. I don't know about yourself, Andrew, but it's...
Well, I've only DM'd two systems, so I wouldn't know.
Oh, I thought you did Pathfinder as well.
I didn't DM Pathfinder, I only played.
Okay. Yeah, I wouldn't be intimidated by it. It's actually a pretty forgiving system. There's a lot of randomness and tables there that does quite a bit of heavy lifting as far as setting things up. Just embrace it. Embrace the chaos. Like, let your players fuck up. That's kind of half the fun is...
Like, open an APC that's got a grenade mountain. Yeah. Let them do that.
Yeah. Have some fun with it. Don't be scared of having a negative game with a negative bad ending, because that's Mothership.
One thing we did was, when something's obviously narratively supposed to be, oh, you've just pulled a pin on a grenade, you die. No, I want to roll that wound. I want to see what wound you get and then just go from that, even though it doesn't make sense narratively. Like, oh, you blow yourself up a grenade. Hmm. But what if it was a dud? Yeah. What if someone jumped ahead, you know? So when Fish went down,
yeah,
he didn't instantly. You said, I'm dead. It was a critical grenade, but we rolled it each wound, and it turns out he was just in a coma. That's what I like to focus on, random.
And as a joke, my backup character, I did roll his later off table. Technically, he survived too. And I went, he just fucking blew himself up with two grenades. No, he didn't.
Well,
I
was going to say, I would, if you enjoy Dungeons & Dragons, I would even force yourself through at least playing a couple one-shots of Mothership and letting yourself dive into the chaos of it all and taking those lessons back to D&D, even if you don't stick with Mothership.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of the willingness to let the game happen is has some really good results for the role play of it all, while also having, you know, yourself go, oh, it's okay to take risks, or it's okay to, in some instances, not take risks because, yeah, there's consequences. So you get to take that back to other systems, and it probably would enhance the way that you think about things if you did allow yourself to experience that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's true as well, because it's interesting, and I think it's good for you to not have to, like, the purpose of the game being you being the hero, right? Like, you do heroic things, you become this, like, all-powerful, you know, when you reach super high levels, you become this entity that's, like, super powerful, and your whole purpose usually is to, like, save the damsel in distress or kill the dragon or whatever, and it usually has a good ending that makes the group feel like they've achieved something momentous. When you come to something like Mothership where you're just like regular people who are trying to do something in like a terrifying environment where no one's a hero, it kind of gives you a different perspective, which is kind of what like what you were saying, Josh, where you can take that back and apply that to like, okay, we're in a fantasy setting. Yes, people do heroic things, but your whole character doesn't need to be based around the idea, the concept of being a hero.
Yeah, you can do, normal people can do heroic things. It makes more of a difference, yeah.
Yeah. Don't be Superman, be an Oscar Schindler.
Okay, yes. CD asks one more comment regarding the end scene. Doug, you haven't heard the end scene either.
No.
They say, I would be curious to hear how you explain the scene if my interpretation matches up with what I missed. The end scene was descending through the level 5, the core, going down the super-cooled computational heart into Monarch's core, which is, funnily enough, Doug, an upside-down pyramid, a la Ghosts of Gornegrim, very good, and had all these monitors around showing Monarch just observing everything that happens in the deep. It had monitors of the war in Eden. It had things of you going down for the first time, other ones fighting, security, troubleshooters coming in. It was just monitoring everything. And it went into one screen. pass through the screen into a cryo bed, 8 bays, and a cryo bed opened, and a bald-headed man rose up, looks around and goes, "Oh, shit," and sees the faces of Tony, Cameron, not Dr. Craig, whoever was there. It was just you guys, wasn't it? Yeah, seeing the faces of his friends who were brain scanned. They got brain scanned in the last room, one of the last rooms. And the final scene was seeing Monarch going about all these things that are happening and then finally focusing on to them waking up, their copies waking up in the deep. Great.
That's pretty good.
Let us lead everyone out for the outro. That is it for now. Here we go. Thank you all for indulging us one more time. We hope you have enjoyed this Q&A. We certainly have. And it's brought us some closure to our fantastic campaign. We'd like to thank all our patrons for their support over the last year. This would not be possible without you, the whole campaign, everything. The last year and more. I do have insert giant Patreon list here. I have given a shout out to a lot. But I might give a shout out to the latest patron members, Nick N, Bobby, Jammy Jelly, Paul L, and Preston. And the rest I have given a shout out in another bug hunt, I think. Anyway, thank you very much. Coming up next, we'll be releasing John's original module, sci-fi corporate satire horror one-shot, Homeostasis. It's a mouthful. In Homeostasis, you play the role of a short-term contractor for the agricultural megacorporation Squam Inc. to enact morally and legally dubious logistical activities on the industrial farming planet Pelus Profundus. Here you will learn how the sausage is made, mow down pests, and do some union busting, and that's all. That's all you will do. If you do anything else, your contract stipulates that you can't talk about it. It's very good. Trust me. Sam knows.
That was fun.
Homeostasis will be exclusive to Patreon and is releasing on the May the 3rd. Jeez, that's soon. I've got my work cut out for me. It will probably remain exclusive content at least until I finish the monumental task of making all the campaign videos, some of which are on Patreon already. I know the first one is, and which will soon release on YouTube. We have been Nobody Wake the Bugbear. Please join our community Discord and chat with us. We've got about 55 members over there at the moment.
Wow.
So far, yeah. You can also follow us on our socials at NWTB Podcast and at NWT Bugbear on X/Twitter. Make sure you check out the one-shot videos on YouTube at NWTB Podcast as well. If you like the show, you can do us a big favor and review and rate it as much as you can. It will help spread the show to more people. I have been Andrew the Warden. Josh has been sleepy. Doug has been happy to be here. Sam has been an anagram of player. And John has been away for 3 of his 24 months. Thank you for listening. Until next time.
Peace.
Yeah. Anyone want to say anything?
Thanks for listening.
Till next time, here's another example of awkward silence where Andrew is expecting us to know what to say.
Sam.
Bye.
Toodles.
It's on brand.
It's on brand. See ya.
Entirely on brand.
It's on brand.
In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void. And darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters.
Everyone do a sound check again. 1, 1, 1, 1, 1.
3.
It's all moving. Yeah, we could all hear each other anyway. All right, finish your chips. Give yourself a minute to swish your mouth and I'll begin.
I really enjoy the latest Batman spoofs where they've still got the guy who did the original Batman spoof, like college humor videos.
Pete Holmes.
And they've got the latest, like someone doing the spoof of the latest Batman, the Robert Pattinson one. And they're sitting at the table from, my cow goes up. This one.
Goes up.
This one, he's like, oh, like he's all out of it. And he's like, are you okay, man? And he's like, what do you got there? He stabs himself. Like starts punching the table. He's like, you want a hit? He's like, what are you talking about? It just gives me a little bit of gold before I fight crime. And he's talking about like how the Robert Pattinson version juices on venom toxin before he goes into a, like a big fight.
It's adrenaline harvest from a bull's cock. All right, let's go.
Kids.
Okay.
One moment. My
I thought I could hear him. I was like,
there's a child there afoot.
A child.
Stop touching my foot.
There's a foot of foot.
There's a foot of foot.
In the land of Albion. In the land of Albion, Merlin learns his craft.
All right, where was I?
That wasn't bad.
You finished point five?
I'm finishing point five.
I will turn you into a pizza.